Today I want to begin a new series of sermons on the meaning of persons. Hope to continue this series between now and the day of Pentecost, Sunday, which is May 21st. Who is the human creature? What is the ground of his worth? What are his relationships, and how does he or she make sense out of them and live effectively in today's world as a person? As I see it from the biblical perspective, there are three basic relationships possible for a person. And the composite of these three make up the meaning of a person. The relationship with his creator is prior. Secondarily, the relationship with himself. And then in the third sense, the relationship of the self toward the world. Let's briefly look at these three. First, the most primary relationship of all is that of a person with his creator. Now, I'm not saying this in a sentimental sense. I'm saying it in a very basic theological and philosophical sense. This is the biblical perspective. We were made to know God. From the Bible standpoint, when I'm in relationship rightly with God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, then I become most fully human. I am fulfilled. I am what I was meant to be. I achieve my fastest speed, my greatest sense of completion, when I am rightly related to my Creator. That is the hard-thinking, basic, biblical persuasion. It's the bias of the Bible, Old and New Testament. That only when I'm in relationship with God do I know who I am really, and do I find out my own identity and personhood. The Westminster Catechism, which is the old catechetical statement of our faith in the Presbyterian Church, goes way back to the 17th century. It opens with its first question, a very famous question. What is the chief end of man? Is question one of the Westminster Catechism. And the answer goes like this. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. The Westminster Catechism was endeavoring to bring into focus the biblical persuasion, the biblical insight into man. And the most primary relationship of all in understanding what a person is to see him in terms of his creator. Now, when this fundamental relationship is ignored or broken, the result, from the Bible's point of view, is disorientation. In Romans 1, Paul describes this crisis in terms of idolatry. His logic goes like this, that when I am not rightly related to my creator, man, by nature being incurably or instinctively religious, when I'm not rightly related there, if that isn't the source that I, if the true source from which I get the meaning to my life, I will irresistibly drift toward other reference points, which the Bible calls idolatry. In other words, if I'm not rightly related vertically with God, I'm going to find something else to worship, something else to circle my life around, something else to become the clue, the answer to what I am. And Paul's point in Romans 1 is that when I do this, when men exchange, he puts it this way, when I exchange the glory of the immortal God, I will always then drift into other lesser reality, other lesser fixed points from which I'll gain meaning, and they then will deteriorate on me. In Romans 1, Paul puts it like this. Claiming to be wise, men became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. It's very interesting in this list that Paul makes man's choice of idols. The first choice in Paul's list, and I think it's very shrewd in Paul's part, is to make man the first thing I choose to worship other than God. And this is probably the best thing. If you're not going to worship God, the best thing in created order to worship would be man, because man is the glory of creation. But Paul's point is this. Even such a glorious part of the created order as man himself, myself, even something as lofty as man, it will not, man himself cannot bear your worship. You worship your husband or you worship your wife. I think we know this more from experience already at that level. But you worship some great political leader, you worship your parents, you worship your children, and they will not bear the weight of worship. And Paul's point is that when I worship something else other than God to get meaning to my life, that idol will deteriorate on me. And in Paul's list, he says men worship images resembling man, mortal man, and then the birds, and then animals, and then reptiles. And his list is a downward spiral. I worship another human being, to give meaning to my life. I sought that as the reference point. It let me down, so I choose the birds to worship. And men throughout all the ages have worshiped eagles at one time or another. Perhaps it can defy gravity. I don't know why, the fascination of eagles, the strong eyesight, something like that. But we worship the eagle. Finally, the eagle lets me down. As I saw that my human heroes had clay feet, then I realized that my eagle has clay wings or something like that. And he can't do it. He doesn't come up with the solution to my ennui and the meaning of my life. So then I worship the animals. I remember the shock when I went through Egypt in 1960 and went out to see all the pyramids. And this is going to be a big letdown for you if you go as a tourist to Cairo and they take you out and show you all the pyramids. It's kind of a letdown to realize that only three of the pyramids are built to people and all the rest are built to bulls. Sort of a letdown. Did you know that? That almost all the pyramids out in the great desert of Cairo were built for bulls, animals, cows. And there are these huge sarcophagi that are in these pyramids, and inside these sarcophagi were cows. So the Egyptians started by worshiping Amun-Ra, the man god, and then that worship began to deteriorate. And at one point in their life, they worshiped the condor, and then they worshiped the bulls. And finally, and Paul's list is very interesting in terms of the last rung on the ladder, finally they worshiped the cobra. Paul's point is this, and he makes it very poignantly, that when men worship something other than God, what they worship will always deteriorate on them. And so that I begin by worshiping man, but I end by worshiping the snake. And worldwide, and throughout the whole history of man, the serpent has always been the symbol of what men fear. And that's Paul's point. That when I don't worship God, I'll end up worshiping the devil. I'll worship what I fear. I'll worship death itself. I never intended it to go that way. But whenever I choose something other than God to give meaning to my life, what I do choose to give meaning to my life will fall apart on me. And I'll end up worshiping the thing I fear, hoping perhaps to strike some bargain with death, hoping to strike some bargain with what I fear. Well, that's the biblical portrayal. That there is the primary relationship of all for man is that a person is related to his Creator. And out of this right relationship with God, Paul calls it idolatry. When this happens, I drift to other reference points. They always fail me. You know, in 1927, one of the great American poets, E.E. Cummings, began his great career as an American poet. And he began it with a whole collection of pessimistic and angry poems. He was sort of the angry young man of American poetry in those days. And he wrote a series of poems and in that little series of bitter and hostile poems, written by a man, a secularist, he doesn't write in any sense from a Christian point of view, but he writes as a secular man, observing the deterioration. Mind you, this is written in 1927. As he observed the deterioration of a then modern man. And one of the poems he wrote was a little poem called Humanity, I Love You. Now, don't be led astray by the use of the word love here. He's using it in a very contrived and special sense. And this is a remarkable poem. Because here, this great poet was observing the deterioration of men with their idols. He doesn't call it idolatry, but it's obvious that's what it is. Men worshiping something, latching hold of something to give meaning to their lives, and it collapsing on them. I'm going to try to read the poem. I say try because E.E. Cummings wrote a little bit like the New Testament. You know, the New Testament was written without capitalization, without punctuation, just one solid sentence. Which you really sense when you read Paul's letters, because he never really stops an idea. It's just one continuous sentence. Well, E.E. Cummings wrote his poetry the same way. No capitalization and no periods, no punctuation whatsoever. So, in effect, you're expected to read the whole poem in one breath, I suppose. And I'll try to do it. I think that was part of the plot of the poem. He wanted to not only reflect on man's deterioration, he even wanted the readers of the poems to deteriorate, too, while they read it, to fall apart. It's a remarkable poem. Humanity, I Love You. Let me read it to you. Humanity, I love you because you would rather black the boots of success than inquire whose soul dangles from his watch chain, which would be embarrassing for both parties. And because you unflinchingly applaud all songs containing the words country, home, and mother when sung at the old Howard. Humanity, I love you because when you're hard up, you pawn your intelligence to buy a drink, and when you're flush, pride keeps you from the pawn shop. And because you are continually committing nuisances, but more especially in your own house. Humanity, I love you because you are perpetually putting the secret of life in your pants and forgetting it's there and sitting down on it. And because you are forever making poems in the lap of death, humanity, I hate you. I'd like to analyze that poem briefly for you. Humanity, I love you because you would rather black the boots of success than inquire whose soul dangles by his watch chain, which would be embarrassing for both parties. Here's a kind of idolatry, isn't it? The kind that worships some scheme or means of getting yourself ahead and doesn't inquire the damage being done to other people. E.E. Cummings saw this happening in his own time. Then he tackles, I suppose you might say, the false promises of maybe patriotism or certain slogans of his own time. And because you unflinchingly applaud all songs containing the words country, home, and mother when sung at the old Howard. Humanity, I love you because when you're hard up, you pawn your intelligence to buy a drink. But when you're flush, pride keeps you from the pawn shop. This sort of inconsistency of man, I suppose, is what he's after here. Willing to pawn our intelligence and then not be willing to admit that we've done it. And because you are continually committing nuisances, but more especially in your own house. This is very interesting, that he decides to zero in on the fact that our greatest failures occur in our own homes, in our own, where we're in closest. Humanity, I love you because you are perpetually putting the secret of life in your pants and forgetting it's there and sitting down. This is really close to home, doesn't it? To forget what's primary, to take a secret, to actually get a secret, and then to forget about it, put it in your pants pocket, sit down on it. What an analysis of our time. And because you're forever, and then finally at the end, Cummings decides to zero in on himself. And because you're forever making poems in the lap of death, humanity, I hate you. Well, now what's he getting at? Here you have a secular writer making the same sort of reflection that Paul makes from a biblical point of view. This man, Cummings, was able to see in 1927 the sort of sensate drift of Western culture at that time. And he doesn't like what he sees. What, in effect, he's portraying is men and women out of focus in terms of what is our adequate loyalties and adequate reference points, selecting something else. And what Cummings was able to see from a secular standpoint is that what we choose tends to deteriorate. You know, in effect, today, we have an awful lot of observers of our scene who see this deterioration clearly. Well, if we're going to understand the meaning of persons, we have to understand this primary relationship. The primary relationship from the biblical point of view is my relationship with my Creator. And when that relationship is severed, everything falls apart on me. Let me leave that aside for a moment. Let's move to the second two. The second relationship is obviously the relationship with myself. We are today in a period of intense internal introspection. And I don't think this is bad. I think we're going through a period right now where consciously our generation is trying to find the source of its own identity, find out who we are and what makes us what we are. Dr. Munger last week made, I thought, a very interesting observation in his sermon. He said, if you ask a person today how things are going, just a bland question like this, whereas perhaps 30 years ago, people would answer that question, especially students, say, at the university, would answer that question in terms of his career plans or some organization he was a part of. He might tell you about his fraternity or his sorority. He might tell you about the school he was in or these sort of things. Dr. Munger made the observation last week that from his own experience, and I could certainly echo it from my experience on this campus, he said that when you asked a student today how things are going, they almost always answered in terms of what they found within themselves, how they felt about themselves and their relationships. That's how people answer the question. And I think he's right. Today, the question, how are things going, is almost always answered in terms of how I feel within myself about who I am. We are today in the midst of a plunge and a almost desperate attempt to find out what we are and who we are. So this second part of the biblical understanding of personality, of persons, is very crucial to our time. But let me make just two observations. We're going to have more to say about this in this series because we want to really try to talk about you and your uniqueness. But it's significant that the Bible never advocates a desperate kind of introspection. You know, it's not the Bible. It was the Greek Diogenes who said, know thyself. And that little quotation, know thyself, many people have in their desks and have it on their walls and assume that it's a Bible quotation. But believe me, just like Benjamin Franklin's quotation, God helps them that helps themselves, is not in the Bible. We think a lot of quotations are in the Bible, but that one's not. Know thyself is not in the Bible. That's not a biblical injunction. That's a Greek injunction. Know thyself. And we have a lot of us today that are really into that bag. If I could know myself, then that presumably is going to answer all my problems. But the biblical view is always, know yourself in terms of your relationship with God and your relationship with your neighbor. The Bible always sees man in a whole sense. It sees man realistically. Now, this does not deny uniqueness as a value of great importance in the Bible. Remember a few months ago, I preached a sermon on baptism, and I tried to bring these two points in dialectical tension. That in baptism of an infant, we take that child away from the parents, the pastor does. There's always a lot of screaming at that point. And the child is taken from the parents, and I baptize this little baby in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And he gets his Christian name. And I made the observation to you that in a baptism, we never say, like when my son was baptized, it was not Jonathan Mark Palmer, I baptize you. But it's always Jonathan Mark, just the Christian name is used, to signify to everyone that this child is unique. He has a unique worth before God. He's not the property of those parents, really, in a sense. Parents don't own the child. That is to say, your decision about the child is not the only decision to be made. It's not the ultimate decision. The child has his worth settled before God. And I pointed out there are some amazing implications of that truth. It means that you do not have total control over that child. It has great implications. All right. But at the same time, it's you, the parent, that gets the right to name that child and give them the Christian name. And the baptism occurs in the family of the church. And the child following that baptism is given back to the parents. Very quickly, as a matter of fact, back into their hands. For them to treasure and to raise as a stewardship. All right. So that notice, the two things are kept in dialectical tension. On the one side, the uniqueness of the child is affirmed. Your uniqueness as a person. And on the other hand, that uniqueness is immediately mixed with the relatedness, the connection points. In other words, Christianity is in no sense views man as if he were autonomous. Now, for this reason, the Christian hope is not a hope about you as a solitary unit being somehow rescued and saved out of this rat race, out of this world. That would be escapism, and that's not the Christian hope for salvation. That's why the Christian hope is not the immortality of your soul, but the Christian hope is the resurrection of your body, the whole of you. And when Paul talks about salvation, he's talking about the salvation of the world as well as the Christian. It's the whole of it that makes sense. And we believe that the whole world is waiting for the sons of God. And Paul has that marvelous phrase in Romans 8, that the world is standing on tiptoes waiting for the sons of God to appear. In our salvation, the whole world is blessed. This is the whole Christian, the sources of the Christian doctrine of ecology. Everything has meaning in what God's doing. Your salvation is not of you as just a unit, but it's Cornelius and his household. And then there's that marvelous passage in one of the letters, in the pastoral epistles, where we are told that the godly husband is a blessing to his wife, and the godly wife is the blessing to her husband. In other words, we're all bound together in this. That doesn't in any way rule out your individual significance or freedom, but it sees that it's in dialectical tension. That means the Christian hope, then, is not for you as a solitary individual unit, as if that were something to be prized, sort of snatched and rescued, then placed over here on the shelf like a museum piece to be honored. That's not the Christian view of you. But you're seen as a unique person with your own selfhood in relationship upward and in relationship outward. All right. Now the third observation. The third relationship, then, in the meaning of persons, would be first, your relationship with God is prior, your relationship with yourself, and we'll have more to say about these in the next few weeks, and thirdly, your relationship outward toward the world. And I see this outward relationship in two dimensions. First, in an interpersonal sense. That is to say, my relationship with the world as a male or as a female. My relationship as a daughter or a son. As a wife or a husband. A person with people. Personal. My interpersonal connection points. How I am interconnected with the world. So this means, from the biblical point of view, it's terribly important to understand what it means to be male. What it understands to be female, what it means to be a son, to be a daughter, to be a wife, to be a brother, to be a sister. These are prior. So that the interpersonal sense of my personhood, this helps me to understand who I am. That's why you can't even talk about the word personality without talking about the neighbor, who becomes the analogy by which I understand who I am. And I want to, in the next few weeks, I want to talk to you about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman in today's world, what it means to be a son, to be a family. You cannot talk about the meaning of persons from the biblical point of view without talking about families, without talking about sex, what it means to be male, to be female in today's age. Talk about confusion in our time. There's confusion here, like we've never seen it. But secondly, there is another sense, another dimension in my relationship with the world, and that is my relationship with the world seen vocationally, or in terms of my task, my job, what I have to contribute, what I have to give. Or this opens up the whole biblical doctrine of spiritual gifts. What I have to share. That's also another connection point with the world. Now, having sort of given that introduction, let's take a look for the few minutes I've got left to another text to see the first relationship as the prior one. It's essential that we see that the most basic of all the relationships is my relationship with God. And in this morning's text, we had a text read to you from 2 Corinthians 5. And I want to refer to that text as we close. This is a remarkable little paragraph, verses 11 through 14 or 15 in the 2 Corinthian letter, Paul's, because of the hidden agenda that lies behind the letter. The letters that Paul writes to the Corinthians are written under a kind of cloud because the Corinthian church is angry at Paul. And there's a rumor, there is a whispering campaign going on in the Corinthian church against this old apostle. Some people have accused him of not being spiritual enough. Others have accused him of being out of the will of God. There are all kinds of accusations that have been leveled against Paul, and you see them coped with in the letter to the Corinthians. But one other charge that's been leveled against Paul that's very difficult to defend himself against is that some people have actually hinted at the fact that perhaps Paul has had too many shipwrecks. He's been around too long, he's been in prison too many times, and he's lost his mind. He's actually gone crazy. And you know, how do you defend yourself against that charge? Somebody says, you know, you're really a little paranoid. Or somebody says, you know, you're a little neurotic, which is a little easier to say because so many of us are. But somebody comes up to you and says, you know, I think you're neurotic, or I think you're paranoid. How do you defend yourself against that charge? Supposing a person says to you, and you say, I am not neurotic, I never have been. And then they say, see how defensive you are? Proves it. Can't win. And that's exactly the dilemma Paul's in. The Corinthians has got this whispering campaign going around that he's actually confused. He's a nice man. He's done a lot of good. You know, these things, these sort of statements always start with a little flattery. Beware when the flattery starts. Now, you've done a lot of good, Paul. You've been a great deal of help. You got the church going and all. But these shipwrecks have taken a toll. And these prisons have taken their toll. And Paul, right now, we think that you'd better not write so many letters. And you'd better go out the pasture to a retirement home or something and just stay away from the churches at Corinth. You're causing too much trouble. And that's the context under which Paul writes four letters to that church. They should never have suggested he shouldn't write letters, because he really gave them the letters. And some of the greatest things we have in the New Testament are those letters. So Paul finally has to cope with their challenge, the accusation that he might be beside himself, he might be insane. And I love the way Paul handles that. He decides to answer the question this way. He decides to say to the Corinthians, listen, I'm going to tell you what motivates my life, and then you decide whether that's mental health or mental illness. I'll just tell you what motivates me, and then you decide. And that's his approach. Now listen to the text with that in mind. Therefore, he says, knowing the fear of the Lord, the awe of the Lord, we persuade men, Paul says, but what we are is known to God, and I hope it also is known to you. Now, he does say that at the beginning, you know. He says, God knows who I am, and I hope you know who I am. We are not commending ourselves to you, again, but giving you cause to be proud of us so that you may be able to answer those who pride themselves in a man's position and not in his heart. This is about as close as Paul gets to being defensive. He says, now I'm not going to get into a big hassle with you about how good I am. I'm not going to try to commend myself to you. I just hope you'll be proud of me. And in other words, that word pride there is used, I hope you'll honor me. And I hope you'll be able to see that you should evaluate a man by what's inside of him and not what he looks like on the outside. That's all he says. I just hope you'll do that much for me. And now, because he says, I'm not going to get into an argument about how great I am. And then he goes to share with them what motivates him. For if we are beside ourselves, he admits that, I know some of you are saying, I've lost my mind. But if we are beside ourselves, he says, it is for God. Now that could be translated, blame God. In other words, if I'm beside myself, you better blame God, because I'm going to now show you that God is what motivates my life. And I'll let you decide when I share with you how the Lord is motivating me. You can decide if it's mental health or mental illness. And then he has a very shrewd, subtle little point. If we are beside ourselves, it is for God. If we are in our right mind, it is for you. Let me try to venture an interpretation of that very subtle point. I think what Paul's saying there is, if I am insane, like some of you say, then blame God. Believe me, he's the one that's motivating me. But if I'm in my right mind, then I'm to your benefit. That's a very subtle point. In other words, if he's warning the Corinthians in a sense, look, if you tell me that I'm insane, then I'm of no value to you at all. So be careful. If I'm in my right mind, I'll be of help to you. If I'm not in my right mind, I'm no help to you at all. So I'm for you. I'm in your benefit if I'm in my right mind. So now, Corinthians, decide. And here comes his great passage. For the love of Christ. Now, he doesn't mean my love for Christ, but the sentence is very clear. Christ's love, he's talking about. For Christ's love, or the love that Christ has, is the love of Christ controls us. Because we are convinced that one has died for all, therefore all have died. And he died for all of those who live, might live no longer for themselves, but for him who for their sake died and was raised. Here's the key sentence. The love of Christ, he says, controls me. I'm sorry the RSV used the word, the English word control, because that's such a hostile and severe autocratic word. The actual Greek word, the old King James said, the love of Christ constraineth me. Which I think was even better than control. Let me tell you about the Greek word. The Greek word is made up of two Greek words. It's the Greek word suneko. Sun in Greek, S-U-N, always means with. It's a preposition, with. And echo is the very short little Greek word for hold. So literally, the Greek word is a composite word. It means to hold with, or withhold, or hold together. That's the idea. Now, this is the way the passage should really be translated. Paul is saying this, and when you think of, you get away from that control word, which is such a, really an unfortunate word to translate suneko, listen to what Paul's saying. He's saying, now I want to tell you something, Corinthians. I want to share with you what motivates my life. He says, the love of Christ, the love that Jesus Christ has for me and for the world, notice he uses us, not me. He's plural, not singular. The love of Christ controls us. The love of Christ holds us together, integrates us, brings together all the loose ends, makes sense out of my life. In other words, my personhood and who I am is held together, and meaning comes out of chaos when the love of Jesus Christ comes down and I appreciate it and discover what that means. It's that love that holds my life together and makes the pieces fit together. You might translate the passage this way. It's the love of Christ that integrates me. Now you, Corinthians, decide if that's mental health or mental sickness. You know, there is a whole school of psychology that says the best way to understand logotherapy, as a matter of fact, that to understand what is giving meaning to a person's life is the best clue to their health. Paul says, what gives meaning to my life is the discovery of God's love. And that not only gives meaning to my life, it gives meaning to your life. I not only see myself as having meaning, but the very next passage is Paul's amazing reconciliation passage, where he says, because of that love, I see the meaning for your life as well. And men and women, that's mental health. That's a kind of mental health we need today so badly. The meaning of persons, then, is discovering the love of God, the love of Jesus Christ, discovering the vertical first, so that I know who I am and what I'm worth. And let me make this suggestion. You'll never discover who you are and what you're worth apart from discovering it in the light of who God is. This is the biblical bias. This is the Christian premise. Because it's in Jesus Christ's love that my life is able to be held together. This is the only thing great enough to motivate me and the only thing great enough to heal and resolve me when I'm in chaos. And that's where the meaning of persons begins. Amen. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the way you have made us, that we are not autonomous islands, but that we were made to be loved and made to love. That we have been made to be persons, upward in relationship with you, outward in relationship with our neighbor, and inward with relationship to ourselves.
that you treasure us and have given us meaning to our life. Now help us in these next weeks to understand what this means to be a person in today's world, in an impersonal, mechanistic world.